Welcome to SCD Church's podcast. You can always join us for our live services Saturday evenings and Sunday mornings out in our West Auditorium. You can also tune into our services live online at seacoastchrist.org or on our YouTube and Facebook pages. Thanks so much for listening.
Well, good morning. God has answered my prayers and given me the voice that I deserve so that my powers may be, or my prayers may be powerful and somebody will take me serious. I finally have my grandfather's voice. So I'm very excited about that. Glad that you're here this morning. So as a staff, we've been doing this thing where we're taking personality tests. And I recently discovered that in this test that I am a W, which means that I am a wonderer. I ask a lot of questions. I ask questions about life, big questions. I have questions about why people do certain things and why things operate the way that they do. And it's not only true of my everyday life, but it's also true of my faith. Is I have asked a lot of questions over the years, like, you know, primarily, is it true? Is there evidence? Why should I believe these things? And so I'm a person who faith does not necessarily come easy. I still have some doubts and I struggle with doubts. I've shared that with you guys. But through my research and asking those questions, I've come to believe that there's some really good reasons to believe that not only God exists, but Jesus is God and he resurrected from the dead. And so I have the opportunity to invite speakers throughout the year. Some are philosophers, like we have J.P. Moreland, who is a regular guest, and other experts in fields. And today, we're going to be doing that. Just that, is I've invited a real-life scientist. Yeah, he's here. And he is going to be talking about the intersection between science and faith and some of the things that he's learned and observed and how he reconciles the two. And so I want to welcome Dr. Douglas Axe, and if you'll please help welcome him as well.
Thank you.
So I had a joke that I tried on him this morning. He didn't think it was funny, but I'm going to try it on you guys and see if you think it's funny. How do you know if a scientist is an extrovert? He looks at your shoes when you guys are talking. That was the same response you gave me.
I think it's hilarious.
I thought that was good, too. Yeah. Instead of looking at his shoes, he looks at yours. Okay. I know it's daylight savings. Maybe it'll go better.
Sleep deprivation.
Yeah, maybe it'll go better.
That's the only explanation
I can tell it. Anyway, so what we're going to do is we're going to hear a little bit about his life, and we're also going to open up for questions. Is if you have questions about particularly science and faith and some of the overlap, you can text those in, and I'm going to get them right here, and I'm going to get through as many as I can, and we'll see. We'll see where we end up. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself? Kind of like, you know, you're a real life scientist. What does that mean? How did you become a scientist?
Yeah, well, my dad, I thought of my dad as being a scientist and looked up to him. Grew up with three other siblings. He worked at Dow Chemical. This was in the Bay Area. We were not Christians. We all came to faith when I was in high school. My older brother was a sophomore. I was a freshman, and a younger brother and younger sister. So just a beautiful story where we were not churchgoers, weren't Christians, and then just very suddenly that all changed. Mm. That was my freshman year in high school. 4 years after that, I was enrolled at UC Berkeley, Christian school up there in the Bay Area.
Right.
Where I was finding this tension, worldview. I had never seen it as acutely as I did there at Berkeley, where, okay, I know what I'm believing as a Christian, and now these people seem to be... I encountered those ideas, but it was very intense at Berkeley, this sort of materialist... philosophy that the physical stuff is all there is, and sort of a disdain for faith. And it didn't weaken my faith. In fact, I think the Lord used it to sort of prompt something in me where I thought, someone should be answering these things. Mm-hmm. And I was confident that there were answers. I wasn't thinking necessarily that I would be called to that, but when you start thinking along those lines and praying, the Lord calls. So long story short, the Lord did call me into the sciences, but also using science as an apologetic. And I devoted a lot of time.
What happened after that? You continued on in your studies?
Yes. Went to grad school, came down here, went to Caltech as a grad student. And at that point, became very interested in moving toward biology. I did a PhD in biochemical engineering and then took a postdoc. I got married during my PhD. And then my wife and I moved to Cambridge, England, and I took a postdoc to become a molecular biologist at Cambridge University and then the Medical Research Council Center in Cambridge.
And so there's a really interesting part of your story. So when you were there, you were working on a specific area of research that you found interesting because of your faith, it sounds like.
Yes, and because of this calling that I felt called to use science in an apologetic way. So don't take for granted the things that there are common stock scientific stories. Instead, be willing to test them and determine whether they work or not.
Okay. And so the study led you to question one of the staples, at least in biology, which is Darwinism. And there were some repercussions that you would challenge that.
Yeah, so I was years into this work studying genes, doing genetic manipulation and looking at genes in bacteria, trying to find out how much information there is in a gene and how hard or easy it would be for a unguided process to find new genes. And I was almost to the point, I had published some papers, but I was almost to the point where the key paper was, I was gathering the data for that, and I lost my job because suddenly, intelligent design became very controversial in the UK.
And if you're not familiar with intelligent design, what exactly is that?
It's the claim that you can look at the product of intelligence and often infer that an intelligence is behind it.
So if you look at like the design of an animal or something, and you just go, look, this is clearly evidence that this is not random and an accident. This is a design.
Right, and there's an intuitive part where just no kidding,
right.
Duh,
right.
Someone had to have made this. But there's also a rigorous part where, okay, can we actually show that this can't have happened by accident, that this had to have a designing intelligence behind it.
And so the theory that there is an intelligence behind all of creation is a no-no. You're not allowed to...
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that.
Okay, and so... Your boss decided, hey, we're stopping your research.
Yeah, and I don't think it was that he thought this is a bad way to think. I just think it's that he thought, I'm going to get in trouble. And his whole center would get in trouble and be pulled into this controversy, and he was scared.
Yeah.
And so...
We've been told that science is just this rigorous, it's black and white, we're pursuing the truth, and we don't let our opinions get in the way, and it doesn't seem to be that way.
No. Scientists are human,
okay.
Entirely human, just like everyone, all other humans. And so all the human factors that come into, you know, every other sphere, they come into science as well. People have their conflict of interest. They're trying to advance their career. They're trying to get famous. They're trying to get rich. They start up companies. You become attached to ways of thinking and become political in how you're trying to build relationships within your community, within your field, and all of those things are sort of political, and they can be in tension with pursuit of the truth. So scientists do value truth, but just like everyone else, that's one concern among many, and sometimes these other concerns trump the truth concern.
And there's also a worldview. They come in with their own understanding and belief of the world, not based on science necessarily,
right.
But on, you know, philosophical or theological opinions that they may have. And so you kind of said, like, look, if you come in with the assumption that there is no God, this is what, you can't even go down that path. You
right.
have to go down the other path.
Yeah, so you have to flesh out, okay, there is no God. How am I going to explain us, for example?
Yeah. And so there is no option. So intelligent design, that there's a creator, is eliminated before you even begin the process.
Yep.
Okay. So I'm gonna start peppering you with some questions. And the one that, it's funny, we've gotten these at every service. So I'll start with this is, what is the age of the universe?
By my reckoning, no.
the consensus right now amongst the scientific community is around
13.5 billion year
years.
Old.
Yeah. And how strong do you think the evidence is for that? Because, and we'll get to this, is, you know, some Christians can't reconcile the scriptures with the universe being that old.
Yeah. So one of the things I do say, and I understand why there's this tension and why Christians say, no, it's got to be 10,000, not, you know, over 10 billion. One of the things I try to assure Christians who are wrestling with this is that this old time scale, the old time frame, the 10 plus billion years, isn't a sort of conspiracy theory. It isn't that a bunch of bad actors cooked this up and they're trying to sell this. There really is a sense in which the universe gives that appearance. And a simple, can I do the Andromeda thing? If you go out, if you're in a better nighttime viewing place than LA, like if you're off Hume Lake or something, nighttime, look up in the sky, there is a bright patch in the sky that used to be called the Andromeda Nebula, because they didn't know what it was, but it's called a nebula, like this patch that's bright. Turns out to be the nearest spiral galaxy to us. So we're in the Milky Way galaxy. This galaxy's Andromeda galaxy. It's thought by careful high-resolution imaging to have about a trillion stars in it. We've got like 100 billion in the Milky Way. So a reasonable approach would be to say, well, let's assume that the thing we're in, this galaxy, is like the thing that we see up there in the sky. How big is that thing in the sky? And one way you could do that is say, well, how close are the nearest stars in this galaxy? And if that thing is like ours, then it would be the same. Alpha Centauri is our nearest neighbor star, about 4 light years away. You can do a simple calculation and deduce the size of Andromeda that you're seeing up there. And from the angle that you're seeing it, you can therefore calculate how far away it must be. And the distance you get is 2 million light years away. So the simplest interpretation of that is when you're looking at it, you're seeing light that was emitted 2 million years ago.
It took 2 million years for that light to get here. Yes. So that would mean that the universe would be at minimum.
Well, that's the closest.
Yeah, that's the closest.
So then you see these far-flung galaxies that are way further. And so all that to say, there's a reasonable way to infer from physical observation that the universe is ancient.
And there's other lines of evidence. Yep. There's the expansion of the universe and things like that. Right. They would also carbon dating, things that they point to the age of the Earth and the age of the universe. Now, the reason why, and if you're not maybe familiar with why would you even care about this, you're just going, who cares how old it is? It is how you understand the beginning chapters of the Bible, Genesis 1 and 2, is and even beyond that, the first about 11 chapters, there's this chronology of all of these generations of people all the way back to Adam and Eve, which are the first created humans. And people have tallied up those years and they go, it's about 6,000 to 10,000 years is what we have in those genealogies. And so the universe, or at least the Earth, can't be, you know, older than that. And so that gets into your interpretation of Genesis. So there's a Hebrew word, yom, for day. And so you have to say, okay, well, what exactly is a day? Is it a 24-hour period? Or is it more of an indefinite amount of time, or at least? And there's lots of interesting discussions. You were pointing out last night about the order of creation and when the sun was created and how there was days prior to the sun being created.
Yeah, so you have day 4 in the Genesis 1 account. It says the greater light and the lesser light, that's the sun and the moon, for seasons and days and times. But that's day 4. So we've already referred to day 1, 2, 3. So it makes me think that in the Hebrew account, in this account, it's giving a hint that these maybe aren't to be interpreted as 24-hour days. I'm not dogmatic on that, and there's a lot of people who have different ideas on it. I just think it's open to interpretation.
Yeah. So you could sit anywhere on the spectrum of, man, I think the universe is old, and then here's how I interpret Genesis, or I think, no, this is how you interpret Genesis, therefore the universe is young, and you can be kind of anywhere on that spectrum, and I think you're still considered in the orthodoxy umbrella there.
Sure.
Good. Okay, so we got the creation of the universe, and then another question I've got here is, tell us about dinosaurs. I'm not exactly sure if you're supposed to tell us about all the dinosaurs, or if maybe this is just about where they fit in this timeline.
Okay. Well, they aren't all big and ferocious, but my favorite ones are big and ferocious.
Okay.
And my son used to have dinosaur jammies that were probably his cutest. So one of the questions is,
where do they fit in the timeline? So
if,
you know, we're told that dinosaurs existed millions of years ago, which it sounds like you're comfortable with that. But then where were humans at? Do they coexist, or is it prior to creation? And how do you make sense of all that?
I think probably I would lean in the direction of thinking that dinosaurs were extinct before humans walked the earth. And the reason I would say that, not just the chronology that you get from the fossil record, because I don't know what to make of some aspects of the things where they, depending on what layer you find things in, you say that's how old it is. Well, it could be. That's one way to infer it. But I find it more compelling that I would have thought if humans were walking around when T-Rex was walking around, you'd have... That's the first thing I would write down.
Is, yeah, for sure.
Pictures of
on the cave
Uncle
wall, you
Joe
would go, yeah.
being eaten by a T-Rex. That would be on the cave wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't have that, which makes me think maybe T-Rex was gone by the time Uncle Joe came around.
Okay. And so they were prior to the creation of humanity. And then humans were created. Now, that gets us to this question is, were humans created out of nothing, or was it part of the process of evolution? And maybe we're starting to get into evolution a little bit more here too.
Yeah.
But let's start with that question first, the human question.
Yeah, I say humans are specially created as stated in Genesis 1 and then unfolded in more detail in Genesis 2.
So there would be a historical Adam and Eve. They're not just like a representative.
I believe in a historical Adam and Eve.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And there are Christians who don't, and there's different stories that Christians will believe in. And one that was kind of gaining popularity several years back is that, no, we came out of the great apes, and there was never a pair of humans, that we descend from, you know, tens of thousands of these great apes that were in transition. And I just think it's problematic. I think it's problematic doctrinally, but I also think the science is very weak to say that, and that in fact you can scientifically make a case for, no, there was an original pair of
humans. Well, talk us through that. Just give us a couple lines of the evidence that you find convincing.
For the original pair?
Yeah.
Well, so when this, you might have seen Christianity Today, maybe 6 years ago, they were saying human, you know, was there an Adam and Eve? And some Christians were saying, if you look at the genome sequences of modern humans and you do, I won't get into the details of it, but if you kind of calculate back, they were saying it's not consistent with an original pair, that there's some larger population from which we came. And you can do that kind of calculation. This is how science works. It's not that you nail it on the first attempt. You try something, you give an argument, you put it out there, and then people are free to critique it. Well, some colleagues of mine, including Ola Hersha, he's a population geneticist, so this is his field. He's a mathematician who does population genetics at University of Stockholm in Sweden. He teamed up with some others, and they did the computer calculations. They said, no. You can actually get a model that works perfectly well that takes humanity back to an original pair. Now, the date of that pair was longer than the 10,000 years. They had it about 100,000 years. There's numbers that go into this, whether that's flexible, which one of these are flexible. But the point is, they said, no, it's perfectly consistent with the genetic evidence that there was an original pair, Adam and Eve.
Okay. And so when we look at, like, you know, most of us probably haven't taken a science class in a long time. I just vaguely remember there was these, they were looking for these, you know, transitions between monkeys and humans, and they pointed to Lucy, and there was these, how do you interpret that?
Well, I'm not an expert in that area, but the first thing I would say is understand that these are not dispassionate, open-minded scientists who are simply after the truth. These are people who want to tell a story. They want to flesh out a narrative that has lots of holes in it, and they will take every opportunity they can to try to say, okay, this is the missing link. This is what we've been looking for. So you don't have to take them at face value. This is complicated by worldview issues and people wanting to affirm something. And so you've probably been to a museum where they have the clay, you know, makeup of one of our supposed ancestors. And if you look at the description to the right, it will have a picture of the fragments of fossil that were actually found from which the clay full head was made. And often it's a piece of a jaw. It'll be a jaw and one tooth or something like that, or a nose bridge or something like that. And they make a lot of story out of a small piece of evidence, and I think that's characteristic of this.
And the story changes over time.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, like, you're talking about Neanderthals, is the correct way to say it?
We'd have to find a Neanderthal and ask them.
I know a couple. I think I know a few, actually. And you, that story has changed in the recent...
Yeah, because just decades ago, Neanderthal was, you know, not human, subhuman,
right.
Distinctly subhuman, but on the line or on the lineage to humanity. And now it's widely being conceded that they were human. They had music. They made musical instruments. They did art. They buried their dead. They had culture. They had religion. So, it just seems like they were made to be something subhuman because that was convenient for trying to tell a story. And then when more truth comes out, no, turns out they were human.
And so the story, I was saying, I just observe and kind of try to keep up with some of what's going on in the debate between, you know, faith and science. And it's interesting watching just over the last 20 years how much of the story has changed and continues to change.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite pastors, Tim Keller, says, think about all the things that your grandparents believed. How many of those things do we still believe today? And what do you think your great-grandkids are going to think about the things you believe today as far as the facts and stuff like that? So they're constantly evolving, if you will, to new stories.
Yeah.
And so we shouldn't necessarily go, oh man, my faith is shaken because of this new theory.
Right. But for some reason, when the new idea comes out, it's always dogmatic. It's always hyped and dogmatic. We've now solved it.
Right.
And the scientists themselves don't go, hang on. This is like the 27th generation, iteration of this.
Right.
And we'd be kind of arrogant to think there isn't going to be a 28th iteration. Yeah. So, just keep that in mind. Some of it is the press and some of it is the scientists themselves. Some of it is people who aren't scientists or the press, but they just want something to be true. And they go, put it in your face. It's been proven.
2 weeks ago, one of the top Apple stories that kept popping up was, we may have now solved the problem of consciousness. And I didn't even click on it. I go, sure you have. You know, like this
keyword
year.
May.
Yeah, right. Let's back up a step. Is the process of evolution, and that's a big question that we're getting, is help us understand what evolution is and then where you kind of, how you make sense of it.
Yeah. So we've talked before about, it's a squishy word, evolution. It's used to mean different things. And one of the things it can mean is just change over time. And that's not controversial. Another thing it can mean is something like Darwin's universal tree of life, meaning all living things that you see today share a common ancestor. So we have a literal family tree, you and fern and mushrooms and chihuahuas all have a common ancestor. Me too. I didn't mean to just pick on
you. No, it's I've been called worse. I promise.
And then the third, so the tree is one meaning. A third meaning is the mechanism that Darwin gave, which is random mutation, natural, so descent with modification, random mutation and natural selection as being adequate, unguided process, natural process to produce the tree. So those are three very different claims. And if you're kind of playing the shell game, you can get someone to agree to one of them, like there's been change with time, and then assume that that means agreement to all three, and it doesn't necessarily. They're very different claims.
Okay, so the one where it's change over time, pretty much no matter where you are at theologically, you believe that. Like, that's obvious.
Yeah, I mean, you can get complete fossil remains of horses that were, you know, dog size.
Yeah.
And there it is.
Yeah.
So there were small horses.
Okay.
And that means the size of horses has changed.
And you pointed out, we even see it in real time. Like, we see things like COVID, where it was constantly evolving in order to adapt to its surroundings so that it can continue to move forward. So that's not really debated.
Right.
So it's the other two that start getting tricky.
Yeah. The full tree that all living things are related in a literal family tree. And I know people who accept that, who are Christians, mm-hmm. who say, yes, I buy the tree, but it couldn't have happened if God had not made every branch event happen. And that's contra Darwin, because Darwin's theory is no, there's no need for God to do this. It's a natural process.
Okay, so God used the process of evolution. Some people would say that, but you're not convinced of
no.
that.
Yeah.
What do you think the issues are with that?
Well, it's what I set out to study when I went to Cambridge. I was looking at how hard is it to get these remarkable things, and if you're saying an unguided process has to get them, then it's like hitting a very small target by blindfolded by chance. And so I set out to try to measure for a single gene, how hard would it be to hit this target to make this thing produce a protein that works. And it turns out the number you get is astronomical. It's extremely improbable.
Give us the number, because I'm very technical. I like to know these things.
So the published number for this, for a protein that has 150 amino acids. So this is a protein is a chain-like molecule, and they're built in all of our cells by linking amino acids together. And there are 20 different amino acids, so it's kind of like spelling out a sentence.
And they have to be in a specific order.
So each different protein will have a different order, but they have to have the order correct in order for it to fold, become a structure that does something in the cell. So my question was, okay, we know this. We know that these things have to fold to work. How hard is it to get a sequence that will do that? And that's what I measured. And it was published in a paper back in 20 years ago, 2004, in the Journal of Molecular Biology. And the number that I arrived at was 1 in 10 to the 77th power. So that's 1 in 1,000 trillion, 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 trillion. You tracking me?
Yeah. Yeah, I got it. So a lot. That's hard.
Yes, it's hard. There.
Yeah, okay. All right. So difficult, it sounds like. So you use an illustration about the probability of hitting a target with a dart, pretty much. And what was that? How's that go?
So if you... if we put a target, say, on that wall, it's a big wall, and we had a little target or a little bullseye, like a 1-inch bullseye, and we blindfold someone, give them a dart, and sort of turn them around. They don't know where the bullseye is, and they're just throwing. It's going to be hard to hit the bullseye because the wall is big and the bullseye is small. Mm-hmm. And it's the ratio of those two that determines how hard this is, how many times you'd have to do this to hit it by chance. And so with that sort of mental image, to show you how hard it would be to hit a target that's one part in 10 to the 77th, it would be equivalent to a bullseye the size of a hydrogen atom.
That's small, right?
That's small.
Yeah, okay.
On a wall the size of a sphere that encloses the visible universe.
That's big.
That's big.
Okay, so small, big, got it.
Hard,
got it. Small, big, hard. Okay, that's your takeaway for today, guys. So it's
effectively impossible.
Impossible, yeah. Okay. And then that last part, as far as the mechanism goes, is we were talking about another scientist, Dr. James Torr at Rice University, Christian, and he talks about the improbability of the origin of life. So even to get this process started is we don't have a clue. We've been told, and if you remember back to science class, you know, there's this primordial goo and somehow chemistry turns into biology. And he's calling it out and going, no one has a clue. No one knows what they're talking about.
And I mean, we could call them out on that too, but his voice is very potent in this area because he's an organic synthetic chemist, which means he goes into the lab and builds some remarkable little things. He's made a little nano backhoe. He puts carbon atoms together and makes little things with wheels that roll around. He's won a race, like his little car, sub-microscopic car. You shine light on it, it moves. He's made a little nano drill, a little backhoe. So he knows how hard it is to make these
little... So for me, that would be smart.
He's smart. Yeah.
He's smart, okay.
But it turns out it's hard to get atoms to go together to make these things, and he knows because he does it. Not many people can say that.
Right.
So when we were playing with Tinker Toys, he's playing with atoms.
Okay.
And so based on his knowledge from this field, he says there's no way these simplistic stories could work because the steps you need to take and you get part way and then you need to purify away everything else and then you need to jump to different conditions to do the next step. And if you're just talking about this happening by chance, you don't get that luxury. You can't put something in a beaker and then isolate it and then change the conditions and put it somewhere else. And so he's challenging everyone in this field he's giving them a reality check. When you actually have to synthesize something, it's very difficult and there's no way these stories would work. And he's had people who don't know nearly what he knows. There's a guy named, calls himself Professor Dave, who's a YouTuber who's not a professor.
Is he a Dave at least?
He might be a Dave.
Okay.
He's not a professor. Who was like, you know, severely criticizing Tour. And so the two of them got together. I don't know, it may have been ill-advised, but Tour got in a room with Professor Dave, I think it was at Rice, and Dave was just rude, not knowledgeable. And so after that, Tuer's right, Dave's wrong. So Tuer thought, instead of debating someone who doesn't know this, he said, I'm going to pick six experts in the field, top-notch experts. Professor Dave was not on the list. He names six people, and he says, if any one of you can solve any one of these specific problems that I think are the deal breakers for the origin of life, then I will stop my complaining. And he gave them a time limit, says, I'll give you this amount of time. Can any one of you solve these? And none of them did.
I think even, I don't know if it was for that or for something else, but he even put out a $100,000 on the line and said, if you can do this, I'll give you $100,000. To all the professionals that study this, and no one has taken them up on it because they don't really seem to have a clue.
They don't have an answer yet.
Yeah, and you can see this because there's other, there's a bunch of other theories. Like I heard that they're now considering maybe life has come from another planet and then has been planted here.
Yes, I've heard that idea. That was put out by Fred Hoyle, in fact.
Or like Elon Musk, and I think he's a popularizer of this, is we're living in a simulation. Because it's so improbable, it's so ridiculous that we're here. What's the answer? Well, we don't really want to go with God, so we're going to go with we're living in a simulation.
Yeah, and he got at that by just power of computing, saying, you know, look how powerful computers are now. It won't be long before you can have, and we do have simulations that you run on a computer. And he says, well, isn't it more probable then? Isn't it more plausible that we are a simulation than that we're not? Mm-hmm. And he's not the only one.
There's a ton
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, if you go down this rabbit hole, there's so many interesting theories, like Boltzmann's brains. Look it up. It's very bizarre. Anyway, okay, let's continue on. We have some very interesting questions that we haven't received in other services. I'm going to give this one. This one is about vaccines and fetal cells from aborted babies. How do we deal with that?
So I take the question to be the ethical question, the moral dilemma of, is it right or wrong to develop something mm-hmm. by having killed humans to develop it? It's a real ethical question. And I'm very pro-life. There's a whole branch of ethics, though, that deals with to what extent do you need to remove yourself from things that came from something that definitely was wrong?
Right.
And I think that gets really complicated on planet Earth because you could probably trace back everything to something that went wrong. So I don't think realistically you can remove yourself from sin. I think
who's that someone that they could read that would be?
Our ethicist at Biola is Scott Ray.
Yeah, we've had him before. Actually.
Have you had him? So he's our ethics guy at Biola. There's a friend of mine who's at, he's now the president of the Evangelical Theological Society. His name is Dr. Ken Magnuson. He was at Southern Seminary.
Okay.
And he's an ethicist who has written on fertility ethics in particular.
So IVF, things like that. Yeah. Okay. So if you're interested in that, those are some further things. Have you ever been close to losing your faith because of your job or your field of study?
No, but I lost my job because of my faith.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see. Let me go through. This one's about, we got a lot of questions about aliens. Do you think aliens exist? And is there any evidence for it?
I've wondered about you some.
Okay. All right. You're getting a little too comfortable in the third service. Okay. He was very polite in the first service. He's like, oh, yes, Mr. Surratt. Oh, yeah. Now it's like, you're kind of dumb. Okay, so.
No, let me give that a little more.
Yeah.
I've had Christians say, could there be, or I've read Christians who say, yeah, there could be intelligent life elsewhere. The Bible doesn't say there isn't. Mm. It's true that the Bible doesn't say there isn't, but the description in particular of what Jesus has accomplished on this planet seems so cosmically unique. Mm. It's a singularity. This is the one time when the God who breathed everything into existence came into creation and acted decisively to end the split between us, humans, and God. that doesn't sound like something that could replay somewhere else. It seems like it is a cosmic story that happened here. So for that reason, I think we're it in terms of intelligent life. Now, could JPL find some, you know, mold, some weird kind of mold somewhere? Maybe. I have a feeling it's all here.
So do you think there's an argument there? And I've heard it argued that we have not found any, we have no indication that there is, which makes our situation even more unique, the fact
yes.
that there is life here.
Yes, so for sure, if you're wanting to say there is no God, we are a cosmic accident, well, it would be really weird I just said there's a trillion stars in Andromeda, it'd be really weird if we're the only place
right.
in the universe where it happens. So those people want there to be life elsewhere because they want to say this is just what nature does. And it's hard to say that if it appears to be a singularity. No, it's only right here.
Right. And there's, as you kind of get into the study of it, you find that we live in what's called the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah.
Right, where we have this very specific distance from our sun, and we have a moon that's able to kind of shield us. And there's like all these parameters, gravity.
You got the big planets sweeping up all the debris in the outer solar system. There's all kinds of things that are just right for Earth in its solar system, in its particular location in
right.
the Milky Way.
Okay, good. How do you separate scientific facts from your religious beliefs?
Good question. I think the first thing is to recognize that no scientist comes to science without prior convictions. That's just not a thing. And if a scientist says, I'm an atheist, I have no religion, well, the things that you hold to be true as an atheist are basically in the form of a religion. They're things that you can't show that they're facts, but you hold to them and you hold to them tenaciously and you're invested in them. So they have sort of the form of a religion. So I think step one is to recognize that everyone does have this tendency to bring their convictions to their science, and therefore you need to be careful that you aren't letting it bleed into your conclusions.
Okay.
Now, I happen to think that if a minority of scientists are challenging the big theory in the field, they're the ones who are least apt to be jaded by their worldview, because you're going up against the thing, the big established thing. So you've got to get it right. Whereas you can be very lazy if you're holding to the big established orthodox view. You don't have to think very carefully about it because you're not going to be challenged on it.
Yeah.
But you're definitely going to be challenged if you're going and...
So you have to be more rigorous in what you're in your...
Yeah, you really need to... Yeah. You're always considering the other view when you're putting forward a critique of that view.
Right. Okay. Is there any evidence for afterlife?
There is. I'm not well versed on it, but I would say I think that the near-death experience, NDEs as they're called, you've had
J.P. Moreland and John Burke
NDEs,
both came and
yeah. So I haven't studied that extensively, but the things that I've read make me think, goodness,
yeah.
If I were a materialist atheist, I'd be uncomfortable.
Very difficult to explain how people can have these out-of-body experiences.
You could explain a feeling.
Right.
And you could explain, I saw a great light, and it felt warm, and then I came back. But when people observe things that they couldn't have observed if they're attached to their body, it makes you think, well, the mind, soul, spirit must be not the same as the body. It must be detachable from the body, and that's very hard to explain.
And so there's an argument there that your brain and your mind are not necessarily the same thing, although they depend upon one another. They're not necessarily the same.
Yeah, and there are other ways to actually prove that. So the mind and the brain are two different things, but for sure, I give my students a proof of this, but I also give them like the key points. And a key point is we are immaterial mind, soul, spirits knit to a physical body. So, and both are important. We're both.
Yeah.
And for sure, the health of your brain is going to affect your
so
mental.
So it'd be
health.
Like, I'm a person driving a car, and I have to have the car and the person together in order for it to work.
If something goes wrong with a physical car, that's going to...
You're broken
down. Your trip's over.
Yeah, it's over. Okay, good. I mean, not good, but you know what I'm saying. Okay. Did megalodons exist when humans were alive? I don't know anything about megalodons.
Sounds like a dinosaur.
Is that megalodons? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Who created God?
Oh, nobody.
Okay, good. Well, explain that.
Okay, so... Whatever your worldview is, you have to, if you keep saying, well, this caused this. Well, what caused that? Well, this caused that. You end up with what's called a first cause, which means an uncaused cause. Or you have an infinite regress. I'm never going to answer the first cause because I keep giving you another thing. So you in effect, you always have to have a first cause. And if you take the atheist materialist worldview and put it against the Judeo-Christian or the Christian worldview, in this, the first cause is God. In this, they're at a loss. So the first cause might be, what caused the Big Bang? Well, now they try to say there's some sort of matrix that causes parallel universes. So multiverse theory. Mm-hmm. Well, what caused that? Well,
right.
So you back up the materialist view to a first cause, and it seems very implausible. So you can't fault Christianity for having a first cause. All worldviews have a first cause. The question is, what's a more plausible first cause? An omnipotent, omniscient, personal triune God, or some quantum foam or something? And I say it's the foam.
I don't think we've talked about this, but your thoughts on the Big Bang, I think Christians have maybe a misunderstanding that it somehow is in conflict with Genesis.
Which is regrettable, because the Big Bang theory was hatched in the mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. Hubble, his observations were key to framing this theory. What a lot of Christians don't realize is the cosmological theory that preceded Big Bang theory was called the steady state model of the universe. And by that model, the universe has always been. It didn't have a beginning. It's always been, and it's always looked pretty much the way it looks today. So when Big Bang theory came out and said, no, actually there was a beginning, that was an embarrassment to the atheist cosmologists, because they thought, now you're saying in the beginning.
Right.
And that's familiar, and we don't like the
We've
sound
heard that
of
that. Somewhere, yeah.
So that's actually one of the key events in the history of science, where the whole scientific establishment, because of evidence, moved in a direction that goes very much toward biblical truth. And they thought that was awkward, but they couldn't deny it. And that's why I think they've gone through so many contorted efforts to somehow sanitize Big Bang so it doesn't have God implications, and that's why we have multiverse theory.
So if you're interested in studying this, they're called cosmological arguments, and so they touch upon the beginning of the universe, but also fine-tuning of the universe, very similar to what you were talking about when it comes to biology. There's an argument about the improbability of our universe having the fine-tuning that it does, and so there's some great resources you can look up on that. Could God have created Adam and the rest of the universe with the appearance of age?
Yes, there's no reason he couldn't have. So I was talking about Andromeda and where there's this appearance that it has to be 2 million years old because we're seeing light that came from it 2 million years ago. Well, could God have put Andromeda there and then stretched out light?
Right.
He certainly could have. But Here's what I say to that. If he gave us the light, then we don't really know Andromeda's there. Because if he was going to do that and just give us light that indicates there's a galaxy up there, then why would the galaxy be there? Because all we need is the light, and it's going to take 2 million years for us to get the light that's actually from Andromeda. So
It also gets into some weird philosophical things like, well, okay, then if God was willing to do that, and it seems a bit deceptive, he could have created us 30 seconds ago with the all the implanted memories and everything.
Yeah.
We could have just come into existence right now. And so eventually we have to go, okay, what kind of God are we dealing with here?
Yeah, so it's not a ridiculous question. I think these are good questions to get us to think, but I feel as though they're probably that God has not only revealed himself through Scripture, but he's revealed himself through what he's created, and there's this cohesion and truth to the way he's created that I think makes it unlikely. It's not going to be like a Hollywood set where, okay, we need to age this thing, we're going to sandblast it and throw some stuff on it. It's going to be stuff that actually has that age. Now, interestingly, there are ways you could reconcile both a true multi-billion year history to the universe and a six-day creation thing. And the way I would say that is, in my own work in computational biology, we do these models of bacterial evolution, and we can simulate, by simulate, I mean walk through the steps of, say, 2 million years of bacterial evolution. And we haven't skipped any step. It's all there, sequence of events. And we do it in about 45 minutes of CPU time. So is it 2 million years or is it 45 minutes? Well, it depends on your perspective. In a way, it's a full 2 million years, but in another way, it took 45 minutes to do it. And so I think by that kind of reasoning, the two could both be true.
I love that. That's really interesting. What is your opinion of artificial intelligence? So maybe they're thinking, will AI eventually become conscious? And that goes back to your dualism.
Yeah. This is taking up a lot of... I like it. So
this is great. We're going all over the map. There's so many good questions.
AI question, and I'm spending a lot of time on AI recently because at a university, like when ChatGPT came out, I was like, I'm going to have my students use ChatGPT, but a lot of people are like,
I can't wait till they start writing my sermons.
Stick it back in the bag.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
So it's not going away. A lot of people are thinking about how do we do education in a generative AI world, but I brought it to my class because I'd already been teaching about how you know that we aren't just physical. Mm-hmm. We have to have an immaterial mind, and our brain can't be doing our thinking. And I thought, this is great, because if our brain cannot be doing our thinking, then to make a neural net in a computer is not, you're not replicating us. You're not even really replicating what our brain does.
Right.
But if a physical thing can't think, then AI can't think, and it will never become like us in that sense. Now, will it be able to emulate us? Well, it already is.
Yeah.
You can already have a conversation with ChatGPT, but it will never be able to do what we're doing.
Right.
It's totally unaware of what it's doing. It's not thinking about
it. I remember reading an article back in the day, Thomas Nagel, what it's like to be a bat or something like that.
I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah, it kind of explains some of that. Is that right?
Yes, so he is a philosopher of mind. I refer to him a lot in my book.
Okay.
He's my favorite atheist.
Yeah.
He's so honest.
Yes, yes.
He's such a careful thinker. There's another book. So he wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. So he's an atheist who's against Darwinism, and boy, that made him a lot of friends.
Yeah.
But there's another book where he says something like this. He said... it's not just that I want to be right in my insistence that God's not there. It's that I don't want this to be that kind of universe. I don't want there to be a God over this universe. And he calls it his cosmic authority problem.
Yeah.
But what I think is refreshing about that is there are some atheists who say, oh, science forces you to be an atheist. Nonsense. And that's just not true. What he says is, no, there's something in me, a gut thing in me that wants to reject God. Help me think about how to make this coherent. And then he's very honest that Darwin's theory doesn't work.
Mm. Okay, there's so many good questions, and we could spend a couple more hours here, but I want to maybe end on this one. Is God a metaphor for a mystery that transcends all categories of human thought, including being a non-being? Is God the name of some blanket we put over the mystery to give it a shape? So what is God, really, then?
I dialogue with... And I actually did reach out to Thomas Nagel when I wrote my book, and I said, could you read it and give it an endorsement? And he declined, but I did have some dialogue with him. But I find him very interesting, and I interact with him. I refer to his work in the book, and one of the things I say, he rejects Darwinism. He rejects materialism. So he says there has to be immaterial aspect to our universe. Mm-hmm. And the reason he says that is he says you cannot understand consciousness, cognition, and moral sense. Those are the three things.
Okay.
Consciousness, the fact that we're aware. Cognition, the fact that we can do rational thinking. And moral sense, the fact that we know the difference between right and wrong, and it's real. And he affirms all of those.
Okay.
And he says, you can't do this in a material universe. So there has to be something that is like a push toward consciousness and something that is a distinction between right and wrong at the very core of the universe, but he doesn't want it to be God. And later in the book, I say, I think he's acknowledged everything that points to God except personhood.
Okay.
And I said, how is it that the universe produces persons? We're it.
Yeah.
We're persons, unless personhood is part of the source. And so I think I understand why people want to reject a personal God and go more this direction, like it's a metaphor or there's some sort of force within the universe. Mm-hmm. But I think in the end, it's because we don't always want to be held accountable to a personal creator God. But the fact that we're persons, I think, speaks, it just screams that we came from someone who understands personhood. Proof, we are persons.
So there's this, and Thomas Nagel talks about this, is all of us have what we call cosmic authority issues.
Yeah.
Which is, if we admit that there is a personal God, it means we're not in control.
Right.
We're not it. That there is some, there's a law above us, there's an authority above us, which none of us want.
And some of us just refuse. I think we're all on the path from birth of not liking that.
Yeah.
And then unless the Lord does something to change that, that's kind of the path that we prefer.
But you would argue that we can look at morality, that there is objective right and wrong. It's not relative, it's not subjective, that there is this absolute law that transcends us. So there's this God has to be moral, personal, like we are, powerful, immaterial, because it's created all material things. And so as you go down the line of the characteristics of what this being must be like, it looks a lot like the God of the Bible.
Yes. Yep.
I think we're going to end there.
Pretty powerful.
I think that's good. Yeah.
It's a good place to end.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. It was awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. So fun. I wish we could spend more time. You guys sent in so many great questions, so that means you just have to come back and we're going to have to do it again.
I'd be happy to do that.
That'd be awesome. But before we leave, will you just pray for us?
Yes, I will. Father, we've just been talking about you and about the different ways that people think about where we may have come from. And we just want to thank you that you are a personal, all-powerful, omniscient God, and that not only that, you have created us as persons, you've created us with a yearning for you, you've created us in your image. And when we've gone our own way in this way, this cosmic authority problem, as we all have, you are not content to have the relationship between us and you severed permanently, but you even stepped into your created order, your Son, Jesus, becoming one of us, walking alongside us, teaching us, living a life without sin, where we're constantly sinning, and then laying down that life, being crucified and punished by you in our place, that we might be brought into a right relationship with you. So, Father, on these intellectual things where we're wrestling with questions, I just pray that you would give us a peace, knowing that we know the big truth, and in some of these little things, maybe until we're with you in eternity, we won't have answers to all of these things, and that we'd be content with that, knowing that we have the big answers, and that we'd also be confident in our ability to share your light with friends. And sometimes that will look like getting into nitty-gritties of scientific or intellectual conversations, but often it's just going to be a sharing of what you've done in us, a personal sharing. So I pray that you would embolden us in that and that you would give us great confidence in you. And we pray this for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
We hope you enjoyed this message. And remember, we also have live services out in our West Auditorium on Saturday evenings and Sunday morning. Or you can always join us live online at seacoastgrace.org or on our YouTube and Facebook pages to hear these messages in real time.